Recording.
Date, let's see. Today is... Until date. Date and time.
Day of the 9th.
9th. Or 10th. No, June 10th.
Oh,
yeah.
No? No, 9th.
The 9th?
Yeah.
Well, this thing got ahead of itself one day. So it is not the 10th of June, as it says on the screen. It's the 9th of June. We're in Uvalde, Texas, at Farmers Ranch Insurance, on Main Street, interviewing Josue Garza, also known as George Garza. This is for the Mexican-American Politics Project at the University of Texas at Arlington, Center for Mexican-American Studies. And what you're doing is a volunteer interview. You are accepting to do the interview and to give up your rights to your image and your voice and your person for purposes of the interview. It is educational. It is not for commercial purposes. It will go into the archives at the special collections section of the UT library. And in a way, it's your archive. That if you want to put in a bumper sticker or a letter or campaign report or poster or photographs, whatever it is, like your safety deposit box, that can be your archive there, and it'll be with this. This tape will be unedited, and the transcription will be unedited, and it'll be placed just like that. And it will be open to the general public if they have a research interest, because it is a special collection. It's not in the stacks. People got to know, they got to ask, and they got to have a research interest to go and view or read the transcript. You accept?
I accept.
All right. Wes, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, more or less, so we're going to talk politics. But before we do that, why don't you tell us who Josue Garza is? Your parents, your grandparents, where they came from, your maternal and paternal sides.
My father's name was Reverend Josue R. Garza. My mother, Luisa Garza. Luisa Flores Garza. My father was an Assemblies of God minister for over 57 years, passed away about 5 years ago. And this is something that had a great impact in my life as a youngster. I was able to be exposed to a lot of Christian ethics in our family. I am one of 10 in the family. I'm the oldest. I've got 8 brothers and 2 sisters.
Where was your father born?
He was born in Cadarita, Jimenez, Nuevo León, Mexico. Came to the United States as an illegal alien at the age of 14 years of age. And it was through a compassionate act of an immigration officer that he was able to legalize his stance or his status here in the United States. After being deported 3 times in 1 week, this immigration officer, nicknamed El Colorado, with red hair, asked him, how many times have you been deported this week? He said, 3 times. Would you like to become legalized? And of course, you know, in 1924-25, my father answered right away, yes. He gave him a business card, told him to go to the Mexican-American consulate in Matamoros, Mexico, across the river from Brownsville. He said, take this card over there and they're going to give you some papers. They wouldn't even let him go into the American embassy. He was so undressed, or he was not dressed properly, rather. His hair was unkept, and he was working in the field when they picked him up. Anyway, they gave him a passport. And that afternoon, he tried to cross the bridge, but he lacked the nickel that they charged him. And he couldn't find anybody to help him out. So the next morning, after spending the night in downtown Matamoros in front of a storefront, he went back and he met El Colorado again. And the Colorado gave him the nickel that he needed to pay to be able to cross. And I quote El Colorado, according to my father, he says, you are the only mojado that I have given a passport and I have already also paid you to cross the river. Anyway, he...
Do you know the name of this, El Colorado?
No. My father knew him. Everybody called him El Colorado. Big, tall, red-haired immigration officer.
But your father told that story a lot.
He would repeat that story as, you know, it happened yesterday.
How did he become Assembly of God?
He was working for a sharecropper in San Benito, Texas, by the name of Jacinto Tamez. And Jacinto Tamez was a wild man, a barroom brawler, womanizer, and heavy drinker. Real nice man when he was sober. When he was intoxicated, he could turn violent. He was good with his fist. And one day, an old man went to the farm with a Bible in his hand. And he talked to Jacinto and his wife, Juanita, and told him about, you know, the way of life and how there was something better for him. Well, to make a long story short, Jacinto accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as his personal Savior. He quit drinking, womanizing, fighting. He became a very docile man. And he began to prosper financially. And his brother, Jacinto's brother, also joined this little, like prayer group. And he also changed. And then Jacinto sort of forced my father into it, because he had taken out drinking and smoking. And so my father also joined that prayer group. It was more like a charismatic group that got together at the farm, and other Hispanic people began to come in. And when my father was 18 years of age, Jacinto shared his profit with my father, who had helped him, and gave him about $300 to go enroll in a Bible college in San Antonio, a Latin American Bible Institute. And my father, with a third and fourth grade education in Mexico, entered the Bible school, had a Spanish curriculum, and after 3 years became a licensed minister with the Assemblies of God under the direction of H.C. Ball. And he started more like a missionary, a domestic missionary in the United States. He opened a church in San Antonio on 19th and Cerralbo Street, I believe, called Templo Betel. It's still there. He started with about two or three people, and now it's a rather larger church. And from there on, he went to another church in San Antonio, and another section of town rather, and opened up another church. And he would actually build a building himself. He was a jack of all trades. He was very talented. And from that other church called El Buen Pastor on Chalmers Street, he went to Houston to a church that was already ongoing. We stayed there for 2 years. And he transferred later to Eagle Pass, again, to start a church from nothing, from the ground up. And that church is still there, Templo Getsemaní. It's located on India Road. My father was one of the founders of that church, and he built it with loans from other church members. And it's still there. From there, we went back to San Antonio to Templo Sion on Hazel Street. And so he stayed there about 3 years and built another church. And in 1950, he accepted the pastorate in Kingsville, Templo Betel in Kingsville, and stayed there about 5 years. That's about the longest time we spent at any one given place. And in 5 years, we were transferred. And we transferred out of that church, and we didn't have a place to go. We came to Uvalde in 1955, and they stayed here 7 years. And then he added on to the church, built a house for the pastor, and transferred to San Antonio. I stayed in Uvalde because I'm married here. And so this is part of our legacy.
Let's go back and pick up your all your brothers and sisters. What are their names? Where are they at now?
Okay. Roberto, the second oldest, is in San Antonio. He owns a grocery store and a restaurant. And Raquel is married. And she runs a refrigeration business out of her house. Her son is in refrigeration, and she is too. And her husband is also involved in it. Then Richard is a farmer's insurance agent in San Antonio, has an office on 410 and McCullough, I believe. And then Ramiro is a Tom's distributor for Tom's Peanuts in Laredo, Texas. He's been in this business over 25 years. Incidentally, I got him started in it. And I also got Richard started in the insurance business. And when you have a larger family, you sort of take care of each other. And being the oldest, I felt an obligation to look after my younger siblings. In a way, Ruben is director of federal programs, I believe, or migrant programs in Stockton, California. He's a school administrator. And Raul is a minister, pastor of a church, and I lost track here of all my brothers. Roger is an insurance agent in McAllen, Texas. He's a district manager for Mutual of Omaha. And Yolanda works for a finance company in San Antonio. And Rudy, the youngest one, is an electrician by trade. Incidentally, Richard, the insurance agent, is also a licensed minister with Assemblies of God. He directs a youth program and is very active in it.
Do you know about your grandparents on your father's side?
My grandfather on my father's side is named Crescencio Garza. His wife, my grandmother, Felipa Garza.
Where are they from?
Cadereyta Jimenez, Nuevo León. And all my kin folks from that part of the family reside in Cadereyta and or Villa de Guadalupe in Monterrey, Mexico. That's where our roots are established.
Now on the mother's side, your mother, how about your grandparents on that side and her? Tell us about her.
Okay, my grandfather's name is Estanislado Flores, also a minister with the Assemblies of God. He pastored a number of churches in the Rio Grande Valley. My grandmother, Juanita, San Juanita Flores, San Juanita Regalado Flores, and my grandfather pastored a number of churches, and they settled in San Antonio in 1941 when the war started because they had three sons that were drafted into the army. And they needed a home base in order to be ready in case anything happened to their sons while they were in war. My grandfather was a barber by trade. And H.C. Ball, the founder of the Bible School, went to his barber shop, which was close or in proximity to the barber shop. Brother Ball, H.C. Ball, was a missionary that came to minister to the Hispanics. And he would cut his hair in my grandfather's barbershop. And my grandfather had two other barbers who were his brothers. Estanislado was my grandfather. Felix Flores was his brother. And so I had another brother named Guadalupe Flores. And he began to talk to the Flores brothers. And the first one to accept the message of salvation, according to Brother Ball, was Guadalupe Flores. And he was a wild man also. He was a drinker, you know, a partier, a party, what do you call the word?
Animal, party animal.
Yeah. And his drinking came first, his family came second. And he changed his way of life. And then Felix Flores also joined the church. And his wife, they quit drinking and smoking and cussing and doing worldly things as we see them. And my grandfather was the last one. And he saw the change, the dramatic change in the lives of his two brothers who were, I believe, younger than him. And they took him to church, Templo Cristiano on El Paso Street. That's where the Bible school was situated. And of course, my grandfather went forward and he accepted the message of salvation. And they were discipled by H.C. Ball, a crash course in the Bible and in theology. After a year, they were assigned to different churches to start them from scratch. In Far, Texas, my grandfather pastored the church in Far, and I believe he started it there. Felix Flores pastored in Del Rio, San Felipe Del Rio. Guadalupe Flores was an evangelist who went all over the place. And they all died in the ministry. And they were the pioneers in the Mexican-American Assemblies of God.
Hey, your mom, brothers and sisters?
There are seven in the family. And but there are no ministers in that family. They just didn't.
So your mom was already in the Assembly of God movement before your father
right.
came around?
My mother, I believe, was born in it.
Uh-huh.
And my mother was baptized in the Catholic Church as a child. Now, all her younger brothers were not. My father was baptized in the Catholic Church, but he tells some stories that really disillusioned him with the Catholic Church. They worked for a large landowner in Cadereyta, and my father, at the age of 11, 12, and 13, would go with his father to work. just for survival. I'm talking about 1920, 21, when hunger was very prominent in that part of Mexico. And he relates a story to me, and I quote him. He says, every time the priest went to the ranch or the farm, they would have mass, they would have confessions. And a few days later, they would get the beating of their lives. My grandfather and his two brothers. And what they were doing, just because of hunger, they were shepherds, they were sheep herders. They would slaughter a cabrito and to feed themselves because of hunger. Well, they would confess to the priest, and the priest would pass the information on to the landowner. And so the rinche at the ranch would just whip the tar out of them, and they could figure why or who was snitching on them. And finally dawned on them that the priest was an informant for the landowner, and it was not a coincidence he was brought every month or every 2 months to have a mass at the ranch. So my father always held that against the church, because they were condoning it. And they were stealing. They were wrong, my father said. We were wrong, but we were hungry. There was nothing else. Money was not available during right before the Depression here in the United States. But he and his father came to work in the Rio Grande Valley for 50 cents a day from sunup to sundown. And that was all they could get. My grandfather returned during the repatriación.
Repatriation.
Right. He went back, but my father stayed. And so he and later became an American citizen. But my father taught us something about being an entrepreneur. My father was never at a loss for work. He could do anything he wanted. He was a carpenter, he was a bricklayer, he was an electrician, he was an auto mechanic, anything that broke down. But he always taught us to work. And I know he would buy us oranges, bulk. We would go door to door in our barrio selling them. And we learned about profit and loss, how to make a profit. We were able to communicate. We learned communication skills just talking to the adults. We would sell tortillas, corn tortillas. My grandmother would make them whenever she came from Mexico. And we would sell them. And we would get a commission from selling. So selling had never been a problem to me. When I was about 13, 14, 15, I believe 16 years of age, up until 16, I owned my own business. And I earned more money than my father. I was a dealer for the Corpus Christi Color Times. And I delivered 800 papers a day in two bicycles. My brother and I would work together. I would collect. I would pay my newspaper bill, my account. And the rest was profit. I'd buy them for 2.5 cents, each paper, sell them for a nickel. So I'd make about $100 a week. And I learned business from that angle, that you've got to make a profit. And this has paid off, because I've never been at loss for a job. I've sold peanuts. I was a distributor for Tom's Peanuts. Later, in 1971, I bought a dealership, or a franchise rather, from Tom's Peanuts, and made a lot of money. And it grew from one truck, one man route, where we had about 10 employees and 8 routes extending from Uvalde west to Del Rio and south to Laredo and Zapata. And I sold the business, made some money, and went into the insurance business. And I like to sell, and I can sell, because I learned that as a child. My father taught us those skills. And he was always of the philosophy that a young man in school that did not work was going to get into trouble. Decía, una mente ociosa se va a meter en problemas. And I can't really, an idle mind will get you in trouble. So after school, we always had a job somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have a chance to run up and down with gangs or just be idle or just looking for trouble, because we were always working, we were tired. And after work, we would study. But he taught us to work. He demanded that we go to school every day. And if we ever got in trouble in school, and we got received capital punishment, or corporal punishment, rather.
There you go.
Man, you pray that he wouldn't find out about it, because we'd get it back at home.
So I can assume all your brothers and sisters finished high school?
And some, but half of them college. And we're all in business one way or another.
When did your mom and dad meet and where?
They met around 1932, 33. They got married in 1936. They met in Kingsville, Texas, mm-hmm. when my grandfather was a pastor there. Mm-hmm. And my father had just about graduated from Bible school and later married in San Antonio in 1936. And they were both in the ministry. It was a team effort. It was something that the whole family was involved. At that time, a pastor didn't make any money. You were not in it for the money because money was not there. I recall stories my mother told me that there were times when I had to eat two or three day old sweetbread that had molding around it, or mold, what do you call mold, yeah. And she would cut the mold off and give me some pan, some bread, because that's all we had. But my father always found a side job, part-time job somewhere, painting, building a house, and he would complement his income with the odd job that he would do, or whatever, you know, that was our main source of income, whatever job he would get. But he was never idle, he was always looking for something.
Okay, can you bring us up to Valle, where you stayed and the family went on and you decided to make this your home?
When I came to Uvalde, I came in looking for a job. And I found a job in a grocery store, Second Groceries, and later on I got my brother in there.
But you were still with your mother and father?
Yes, yes. And that was 1955 up until 1961 when I got married.
So 55, you were in high school here?
High school, Uvalde High School. And we always had to get a job. I mean, we'd look, even if they didn't pay us very much, we still had to get a job. In 1956, my brother was employed by an insecticide company, aerial applicators, crop dusters, we'd call them at the time, loading and unloading the airplanes, marking the roads and the fields. And that was a good paying job, 75 cents an hour. And you'd work 10 hours a day and during the summer. And we began to learn that business. And at the age of about 16 or 17, I became the foreman. I would figure the loads because you have percentages, you have fractions to involve in. I became the foreman in charge of about five or six Anglo men that did not have a formal education and had a lot of trouble figuring the loads that the airplane had to carry. And so later on I learned airplane mechanics. I restored a J-3 airplane. We tore it apart, the fuselage and everything, and painted it, put the wings back, put new fabric and controls and what have you. And what I would do, I would do the work, and the certified mechanic, who was my employer, would just check my work. And then we both went up and tested the airplane, and it flew. But we made a brand new airplane out of an old airplane. And so eventually I received my private pilot's license, taking less. I wanted to be a crop duster, but it was too suicidal. I thought two good friends get killed, and that sort of caused me to lose interest in it. I wanted to live to be an older man. But I stayed here in Uvalde when my parents moved back to San Antonio. I was married. I was a senior at Texas A&I University in Kingsville. My wife lived here in Uvalde with her mother, and I'd commute back and forth every week or every other week.
Okay, what's her name and how did you
meet her? My wife, name is Raquel De Leon Garza. And again, I met her in the church. Our lives have been centered around the church because that's the way we were brought up, and that's the way we believe. I have two sons, Ronald Benjamin Garza. He's an elected trustee at Southwest Texas Junior College. And my younger son, Josue Daniel, he's a licensed minister with the Assemblies of God. He is involved with the youth department, and he is helping a church in Campwood, Texas. He is a missionary at heart. He schedules about three or four trips to Mexico, to the interior of Mexico, during the year, takes some young people from Uvalde, from the area. They'll take clothing, medication, vitamins, toiletries, whatever they can get to take to the poor people over there in the mountains. And that's his calling. I wanted him to be a lawyer. And one day he told me, he said, this is my calling. Don't interfere with it. And he and his wife both enjoy doing that. Ronnie is married to Rachel Ann Adams from Rock Springs. They have three children, James David, Samantha Ray, and Stephanie Raquel. Danny is married to Debbie Aguero from Campwood, Texas. And they don't have any children. And they both travel to different churches ministering to the young people. And his heart is set on it because he sees our young Hispanic young people losing interest in education, losing interest in life, period. You know, going to gangs and going to drugs. And he has a burden for that. And that's his ministry. And he wants to work where youth are involved.
How did you get into politics? When did you first get an awareness of that? And how did you get involved in that?
Well, I became aware of it very much so in at Texas A&I University. And during the farm worker strike, we marched with the farm workers.
1966, 67?
Around that area, around that time. I must have marched about 5 or 6 miles with them. And it was a show of support. And they were on the way to Austin. There was a Catholic priest and a Baptist minister, and I can't remember their names.
Cheryl Smith, and the priest is, that's a priest. The minister is from Houston.
Houston, I can't recall his name.
He used to wear a Jungle Gym hat.
Right, right. And they had a cause that they were trying to bring before the eyes of the state. They were on the way to Austin, and remember, Governor Connally, the Attorney General at the time, Wagner Carr, refused to meet with them. They met him in New Braunfels and told him, don't even go to Austin, we're not going to be there.
Is that part of the 5 or 6 miles you were in, or you marched down in Kingsville?
No, that was in Kingsville.
Uh-huh.
But I kept up with them.
I see.
And I was so disillusioned with those two men that I campaigned actively at that time for John Tower, who was running against Wagner Carr, vice versa. And I took people to vote for John Tower because I felt that we had received a slap to our faces when Wagner Carr decided not to meet with him. And he was a Democrat that we thought was, for the people. And yet he was against the very people that needed his help. I always voted against John Connally every chance I had because of that. And I was just disillusioned with the Democratic Party. But what really got me involved in the local level was the Joe Villegas City Council campaign here in Uvalde. Joe Villegas was the first Hispanic to be elected to the City Council.
So you graduated from Kingsville and then came back here and were working in water. What were you doing? You got out of Kingsville.
Okay, out of Kingsville, I went to La Jolla, Texas, a classroom teacher.
Uh-huh.
Because Uvalde was not noted for hiring Hispanic teachers. And I tried to get a job, and there was...
Even though you were local?
Yes. They kept telling me we don't have any openings, but I knew they did. Well, I went to La Jolla and worked there 1 year and came back and went to work for an insecticide company again, because that was my college money. I must have worked for Art McKinley for about 15 years altogether, on and off. In fact, I ran the airport for him during the school year. I'd work part-time over there. And he taught me to fly. Anyway, when Joe, I still couldn't get a job in Uvalde. It was a week before school started, and I talked to one of the prominent farmers in Batesville who happened to be in the school board here in Uvalde, and I asked for his help. And he happened to be the president of the board, Mr. Lafier, Les Lafier. And he put in a good word. I've known him for many, many years. I just didn't know he was the president of the school board, and the next day they called me for an interview, and all the questions they would ask me, are you a member of PASO? That's the political association of Spanish-speaking organizations that Albert Peña and Henry V. Gonzalez created to help John Kennedy. I said, I never heard of it. Are you a member of LULAC? I said, never heard of it. GI Forum? No, I never heard of it. Of course, I was lying. I had to do that to get a job. And I was assigned to a sixth grade campus.
In Uvalde or Batesville?
In Uvalde.
In Uvalde.
And they were ability grouped. There were 10 sections of the sixth grade from top to bottom, and I had the 10th one.
All Mexican.
All Mexicans, all the supposedly troublemakers. And that was the most enjoyable, one of the most enjoyable years in my teaching career. You know, they weren't dumb. They were good kids. I just understood them.
But they probably were also migrants, no?
They were migrants. And I worked them hard. And they had to pass. And we had reading every day. But they could read. They could read on second or third grade level, maybe first grade level. But they made a lot of progress, and I see some of those kids, or some of those or grown men now, they'll come and visit with me and even thank me. One of them is a young man here in Uvalde that owns a rental company, rents equipment, heavy equipment. He just come in from Mexico, and we pushed him, and now he went on to high school and excelled in high school. But he was in the 10th section of the sixth grade, which was the lowest. You couldn't get any lower because there was no more room. And Renan Olasco has prospered. There are others that have prospered tremendously. But I pushed them and I emphasized reading. And they had to pass their spelling, their definitions, and I believe very strongly in the three R's. And we made a lot of progress. There were some discipline problems, but not to me. We respected each other and we worked together.
How did the other teachers treat you?
Well, they were all right. We had about two Hispanic teachers and the whole school.
In the entire junior high or the entire district?
Sixth grade. And
I
stayed out of the way. They stayed out of my way. And the principal was a Hispanic, YP Canales, a good principal. But his contract was not renewed that year because he was a good principal. He had a good organized school, good discipline. And the president of the school board, Dr. Dimmitt, didn't like him at all. And they didn't renew his contract, and we were helpless because we didn't have any political power, any influence to initiate any action, any protest. We were politically powerless, not only politically, but economically speaking. At that time, I believe we controlled only 2% of the economy here in Uvalde, 2 cents out of every dollar. So we had no power. That's when Joe Ortegas came in and filed for the city council.
Now his family is local, no?
Oh, yes, yes. And Joe was a teacher at high school.
They own the grocery store here, no?
They own a grocery store, and his father worked at First Savings and Loan as a custodian for many, many years. And so Joe came in, and he organized a Hispanic student in high school, he and the late Gabriel Tafoya. And for the first time in the history of Uvalde, Hispanic was elected student council president because Joe was the brain behind it. And he was elected to the city council and served in the city council about 4 years. Then right before that, we had elected Jimmy Tafoya to the school board, the first Hispanic to be elected.
Were those at-large elections or by districts?
They were at-large, with a person getting the highest number of votes elected. But of course, after that, the establishment got very smart, and they put places, an imaginary district. It wasn't really a
geographical boundary.
It was just, you're going to run in place one, that's it. But you ran at-large. And that way they could control the election. If they would lose in the primary election, they could always come back and beat you in the runoff, which happened after that. And so I taught school in Uvalde till 1970.
Now, these elections, were they in the early 60s? Were the poll tax still on, or mid 60s? Or when were these elections? Do you remember?
They were in the late 60s.
So 65. The poll tax was already abolished?
Oh, yes, yes. But they had a way of controlling the election. If you work somewhere, your employer would come and ask you to. And you couldn't run because otherwise there would be some retaliation. So in 1970, I...
What did you do in those elections for Tafoya and Villegas?
Walk the streets, take people to vote. And just the gopher.
Is that where you learn how to do that?
Well, yes, I would say that, because Joe was a very good organizer and Gabe was a very good speaker, and he could motivate people and he could bring out issues that they were relevant to the most in need. And Joe and Gabriel began to instill that Chicano pride in the students. I recall that when I was teaching at Robb Elementary School, And even when I was in school, we would take a taco to school with tortilla and frijoles, and we would sort of hide it because we were ashamed of it. But one day at Robb Elementary School cafeteria, a young girl was eating a taco, and she had it hid under a napkin. While she was eating, she had the taco wrapped around a napkin, and I asked her to give me one. Now I was doing duty there, and I began to eat the taco in front of everybody. And kids said, "Do you eat tortillas, Mr. Garza?" "Yes, I like tacos. I eat them at home all the time." "Really?" They couldn't believe it. They thought because I was a teacher, I couldn't eat those type of food. There's nothing wrong with it. Then I'd get the kids to bring me a taco, you know, during the week. And before you knew it, those that were eating lunch, or that brought their own lunch to school, were bringing tacos. And I'll never forget that Gabe Tafoya and Joe Diegas one day organized a soul food day. And all the students, Hispanic students, took a covered dish to the high school cafeteria, and they would eat frijoles and arroz, carne guisada with aguacate. We call it guacamole, and hot peppers. And the school, high school staff was shocked. They didn't know what was going on. They were eating tortilla like we do. We make a little spoon with it, and they were being ashamed of it. And so from there, they organized a Mexican-American youth organization in high school. And it was about the same time, a little later, that I filed for county judge of Uvalde County.
Now, this Mexican-American youth organization is the same chapter of the regular Mayo that was heard of at that time.
Right. And right after that occurred, I decided, after being encouraged by others, to run for county judge of Uvalde. And I ran against an incumbent that had been there for a number of years.
In 1970?
Yes. A very good lawyer, a very sharp man, but very, very conservative. And he would not allow food commodities into the Uvalde County because under the pretense it was un-American. And so...
What was his name?
Leo Darling. And I went to him and told him I had filed against him, and he laughed, and we need a little competition. And so we ran a very strong campaign, but about a week, or less than a week later, after I filed for county judge, I received a letter from my principal advising me that my contract for the 1970-71 school year was not being renewed. And I quote him, he said, "I hired a teacher, not a politician." So that precipitated a walkout. And that walkout was a climax to a chain of injustices that had occurred. 3 years earlier, Mr. Canales had been denied employment, and others had been also denied employment.
Did Uriegas and Tafoya lose their jobs over their activities?
Well, no, but they made it so hard on them that it was almost difficult, impossible to work there. And Odiega said his own grocery store. So he came back to run the grocery store, and Tafoya joined the Chicanos in Action group at the time, or the Texas Migrant Council, I believe, and to help organize people. But Rogelio Perez was sort of phased out because he was also involved in the junior high level. And they just didn't renew your contract. And legally, they could do that. Well, we went for school board meetings one time, and they very conveniently decided to adjourn when we got there. And at that time, Jesse Gomez became my attorney. We went a subsequent meeting, and Jesse asked him for a formal hearing. Give us the reasons. We don't have to give you anything. The subsequent meeting was attended by about 1,000 people in a room that was about 20 by 20, and armed deputies were standing on top of the building. The infamous Captain Alfred Ali sat between my attorney and myself. Of the Texas Rangers. And daring us to say something so he could hit us over the head with a gun. He was armed at the meeting, and he wouldn't let us communicate. And he placed his foot on top of a chair, and everybody had to go around because it was Captain Ali, Texas Rangers. And so we had a formal hearing, and they decided to support the principal.
Was Joaquin Jackson also a Ranger at that time here?
Yes, but he played a distant role. He didn't. He was exceptionally nice to us. But Ali was the bad guy. He was the one that trying to initiate a confrontation. And we kept trying to avoid it because they had the guns and we didn't. Anyway, they terminated formally my employment. And the next day there was a walkout. The walkout was just a climax to a chain of injustices. We couldn't take it anymore. And so the board members were all Anglos at the time. And they felt that they were doing right. In their hearts, they felt they were doing Christian men. One of them went to a meeting with a Bible in his hand. And they felt they were doing the right thing. Our schools were segregated. 99% Hispanic in one school and 99% in the other. Rob and Anthony were traditionally the Mexican-American schools. And they saw nothing wrong with it. Separate but equal, they kept saying. And so HEW came in to investigate. The FBI came in to investigate. And we filed some lawsuits against the school district. I filed one myself to get reinstated. And Mrs. Genoveva Morales, a very brave woman, I equal her to Rosa Parks of the Black Movement. She came forward and said, I'll file the lawsuit. She had 7 children in school. And it was Morales versus Shannon court case. We went before the federal judge, John H. Wood, and we didn't have a chance. There's no way. In my case, he agreed that the board had denied due process and made a number of errors. But he remanded the case back to the school board.
To do it right.
Give him a hearing and follow procedure, and that's all you have to do. Of course, by then they had a very prominent attorney from Houston. I can't recall his name. Cook. I can't recall his first name. And he wrote down what they had to do. And hear him out, hear his lawyer out, and then vote. Make it legal. And so we went back to Judge Wood. He said, well, you wanted a hearing. You've got one. You're fired. Then he turned us down on the Genoveva Morales and E.P. Shannon lawsuit that was filed against segregation. He said, you people wanted to be white for so many years. You're white now, so you're not being discriminated. And Pat Maloney and Jesse Gomez represented us in Del Rio and in San Antonio federal court. Then Maldev took over the case and appealed it to the Fifth Court. It took about a year and a half to get it to the Fifth Court, and they reversed Judge Wood. And the school district appealed it to the Supreme Court. And of course, another year of delay, year and a half, the Supreme Court refused to hear it. And by that time, the Governor Briscoe was elected governor, and it was an embarrassment to him because our district was still trying to perpetuate segregation.
And he's from Uvalde.
And he's from Uvalde. So I heard, and it was just through the grapevine, that one day he called them into the state capitol and gave them a good chewing out and told them, drop your case and do what you're supposed to do. And so they were integrated. We went to, single grade campuses, where all the first grade was in one school, second and third in another one. And it was all integrated. There was a lot of resentment. I lost about 50% of my business overnight.
What business were you in then?
Tom's. I had already purchased a Tom's franchise. And I had about 250 vending machines by that time. And my business kept growing, but then I had, for about 6 months, I lost about 50% of it.
Well, let's go back, because I think you skipped many years into the future. You were running for county judge. That's when you got fired, and you appealed, and you lost. But and then you jumped over to the lawsuit that took several years,
okay,
having to do with Morales. How bad did you lose the election, or what happened in the election?
I think we lost about 600 votes, mm-hmm, And there was a big turnout on the Hispanic side. I think I pulled about 1,600 votes.
How did you campaign then?
I didn't know how to campaign. I went on the radio and I talked to people. I had no formal organization, or just had a big heart, and I had a lot of people that were trying to change things here in Uvalde for the Hispanics. People that cared. And the Hispanic community responded tremendously. We had a small percentage that didn't like it, but everybody knew that there was discrimination in Uvalde.
Did anybody win with you at that time? Commissioner's Court or anything?
No, no. It was impossible to win. Well, after I lost my job, I stayed with the business for about 6-7 months. Then I went to work as a classroom teacher in Crystal City. My brother, who had just returned from Vietnam, took over the route, and he kept it going. He did even a better job than I did. He's an excellent salesman. And gradually we began to get all our Anglo customers that had left us. And they perhaps didn't agree with me or with the cause, but they respected us because we were making a stand on it.
Did you commute to Crystal City?
Commuted for 5 years back and forth to Crystal City, and something real good happened to me in Crystal City. I was able to obtain a graduate fellowship, and through, of course, Judge Gutierrez and Angel Noe Gonzalez, who recommended me for it. And that year I went to California, the California State University in Sacramento, and under a fellowship. There was a stipend involved, and I still had some time on my GI Bill, so everything worked out beautifully. I received my master's degree and mid-management certification, and I came and was employed in Crystal City for about 4 years later. I was principal of two schools, Airport Elementary and Airport Junior High and Grammar Elementary School.
Let me stop you for a minute. What happened to those kids who walked out? Who were some of them?
Well, you have, right now, Dr. Arturo Alonso has a PhD from Texas A&M University. He's on the staff of A&M. We have Alfred Santos, has a master's in economics from Notre Dame. Joaquin Rodriguez, an attorney in Eagle Pass. And I'm trying to think the names as fast as I can. Joe Martinez, Dr. Joe Martinez, who is a dentist in Piedra Negra, Mexico. He's practicing in Mexico, but he can get a license here. He went to the University of Guadalajara.
Did he go through the BECAS program?
I believe he did.
Did any of those kids get drafted and get killed in Vietnam?
Well,
of Ruth Webb?
Some of them did, yes. There was a case here in Uvalde that was happening, and we didn't know how. A high school senior would graduate from high school, and before he could enroll in at the college in September, he was drafted. And it was happening so fast. And he would obtain employment during the summer to earn enough money, because we didn't have federal aid or any financial aid at the time. And by August, they were already inducted into the Army. And so somehow, I don't know, I believe Joe Diegas found out about it, that the high school principal at the time would submit a list to the draft board, to Ruth Webb, of all the high school seniors that were graduating, all the male. And on the Hispanics, he would check them off. And I believe he would rate 1A. And the Anglos, he would put 1S, that they were going to college. So that means we'd go to the draft board, and right away they would get as many Hispanics as they could to meet their quota. But the Anglos didn't have to go to Ruth Webb to get an exemption. Automatically they would get it. The Hispanics had to go personally and plead their case and get an exemption. But if they weren't enrolled during the summer, they would get drafted.
Was any Mexican American on the draft board?
Not at the time. Then Joe Diegas got involved in it. Gilbert Torres, Commissioner Gilbert Torres, got involved in it, and the attorney Mike Gonzalez from Del Rio intervened, and the federal government forced the draft board to name a Hispanic, and Rodolfo Flores, a local attorney, was named to the draft board, and they were monitored by the San Antonio office to be sure that everything was fair and equal. And I know a case where the Ruth Webb called my wife's partner who worked at Sears with her and advised her, tell your son to join the Navy or the Air Force, he's gonna get drafted in 2 or 3 months. And of course the boy joined the Air Force Reserve or the National Guard to get away from the draft.
Didn't Genoveva Morales work at the VAT board? There was a Mexican woman clerk that worked at the VAT board. Do you remember who
I don't recall that. But anyway, we lost 16 young men from Uvalde, all Hispanics, that didn't make it to junior college prior to us being able to do something about it. We lost 16. But they were getting drafted on the rate of 9 to 1. 9 Hispanic, 1 Anglo. And of course, the wealthier families would keep their kids in school as long as they could, even if they didn't make the grade. They would go to summer, they would go to Saul Ross. And
is Ruth Webb still alive?
I think she's retired. She's a very, very old person now. And I hope to God that she's been forgiven for that.
After you ran, who were the next people that in Villegas that did not continue in the city council? Who were some of the other people that ran for office?
Well, after Villegas was elected to city council, he ran for state representative. And he lost. And then Gabriel Tafoya ran for state representative against Dave Howard. And he lost. And so then Manuel Morales ran for the school board. Anita Cano for the school board. Francis Ibarra for the school board. And we kept losing. They were running the election. And if we get 1,000 votes, they'd get 1,500. If we get 1,500, they get 2,000. And they just seemed to beat us by 500 or 600 votes every time. But we never gave up. We filed a lawsuit against a county, and they had to redistrict the county. They gave us a chance for a Hispanic to get elected. The first county commissioner was elected with Gilbert Torres.
Who was the plaintiff in that suit?
Torres.
And who was the lawyers?
Maldev was involved. Maldev has done a great service to this community. And also Pat Maloney and Jesse Gomez, they have really, you know, helped us with legal, as I recall right now. And so Gilbert got elected commissioner. And the judge began to get after him. They took all the heavy equipment, all the machinery away from him so he couldn't fix any roads. And finally we worked something out with the county judge to where he was, you know, after at the end, the last 3 or 4 years he was in office, he was a great fellow. He was instrumental in helping Gilbert pave a lot of the unpaved streets in the west side of town.
This is Darley again?
Darley. I mean, you couldn't believe it. He asked for the community council to be reorganized and strengthened and bring more programs. And you know, when all the streets were paved and all the roads were paved, we let him cut the ribbon. And they said, we'll pave more streets. And he turned out to be a real nice fellow. I mean, very, you couldn't believe the 180-degree turn he made. And then Gilbert filed another lawsuit against the county because all the Hispanics were concentrated in his precinct. So we go to federal court again, and Gilbert kept saying, if you take 30% of my Hispanics, or the Hispanics from my district, we can win an election in another district, another precinct. Rogelio Munoz represented us in federal court, and of course George Corbo came through, and they settled out of court. And the following year, Amaro Cardona was elected as the second county commissioner in Uvalde, because Gilbert and Rogelio Munoz and Maldev pushed it.
Now this Cardona and Munoz were part of those Mayo kids, no?
Right, right. They were the original Mayos. And so Rogelio is an attorney right now, a former district attorney. Amaro Cardona is a probation officer, has a BA degree. And so they've been active. And we kept working at it. We elected the first Hispanic countywide, Maggie Del Toro, who is a tax assessor and collector. She'd worked at the office 18 years and she got elected by a large margin. the school district got fouled on for single member districts.
Who was the plaintiff there?
It was, I believe, Anuel Morales. She's quite a woman, let me tell you.
And the lawyers?
Very courageous. Maldev was involved, or legal aid. I think George Corbo handled that one. And they worked it to where four members were elected by districts, and then three were elected at large. So I was the first Hispanic elected from the West Zone precinct.
What year is this?
1981, I believe. And so I served on the school board a term of 4 years. And then I was defeated. And the following year, I was reelected again. I ran against another incumbent. And I was elected for about 2.5 more years.
Well, let's back up, though. You left Crystal City after about 5 or 6 years of work, and then you came here. What did you do here?
Okay, in 1975, I was elected as executive director of the Community Council of Southwest Texas.
This is the CAP board?
The CAP board, yes. And I worked there until 1981 when I resigned and went to running my own business, the Tom's business. And it had grown so much and prospered so much that it just demanded my full-time attention. My wife even resigned her job with the Department of Human Services to help us with it. And it was a prosperous business, made a lot of money with it. And I began to sell in 1987. Even though we made a lot of money with it, we were slaves to that business. We were owned by that business. And one of the things that really hurt me was the workman's comp. The insurance just kept going up and up. So I was shopping for insurance, and I wound up in Crystal City with Emma Flores, who was a Farmers Insurance agent. And she advised me that they were looking for an agent here in Uvalde. So I made contact and signed a contract with a district manager and opened my own agency. Insured my own trucks and made a commission out of it. And the business has also prospered, so I sold that business to concentrate on insurance.
So did your brother?
Sold part of it to my brother, Laredo. And then I sold the Eagle Pass, Crystal City, and Carrizo to Amado Rodriguez, who worked for me 9 years. And we facilitated the transaction. Amado is from Piedras Negras, he's now an American citizen, but he could speak English. But he was a good salesman. My top salesman, besides my brother. And he is now a very prosperous businessman. He knows English, he learned it. He learned how to say peanuts, cheese crisps, potato chips, fritos, corn chips, bugles. And we taught him all that terminology. And he'd go to the stores and he'd find a way to sell something. He would find a way to communicate with the Anglos. And a hard worker. And he owns a big warehouse in Eagle Pass. And has a very nice home, because he wanted to work. I mean, he wanted to prosper. You know, one of the things that I admired about him, even though he qualified for food stamps, he wouldn't take them. His wife had a child and he qualified for Medicaid, he wouldn't take it. And so that mentality he brought with him from Piedras Negras, Mexico, has helped him, because he doesn't want to be in the same level or status all the time. He wanted to prosper. He's done real well. He's got two boys at UTSA in San Antonio. His daughter is a public school teacher, graduate out of Texas A&I University. And he's been here about, at most, 20 years. But he has that the initiative that's required to be an entrepreneur.
Let me get you back to the first term on the school board. I'm sure that you then had a different point of view. You were now a policymaker, not a teacher. You had experience as a principal. You were on the CAP board running your own budget, your own programs. How were the politics on the school board at that time, first term?
Well, it was quite an experience. You couldn't get anything passed. Everything was set. And one of the best things that we did in the school board was when R.E. Byram resigned. He was a longtime superintendent in Uvalde who was responsible for the walkout. He's the man that fired me. And when he resigned, the next in line was his top assistant, Joe Ammerman. And there was a lady on the school board, Billy Bailey, whose husband was a medical doctor in Uvalde. They were newcomers. And she kept saying, I want somebody else. I want someone from out of town. I want new blood in here. And what had happened in Uvalde for 50 years was that the same system had been perpetuated. The superintendent would retire, his assistant would go in and just keep the same good old boy system going. Well, she and I got together, and Ismael Sosa came with us. We were able to hire Dr. Eddie Little.
How many votes did you have that were Mexicanos?
Just two.
Two, and Bailey?
Bailey, and then she was able to swing somebody else. And so Dr. Little came from Deer Park, Texas, and from that independent school district. Man, we made an assessment the second month. He told us that you're 25 years behind everybody else. We didn't even have a curriculum director. And he kept saying, Garza, I can't believe this. Well, we had a good football team. We won state in 1972. Our coach made more money than the superintendent. And so the district even gave him a house to live in. Utilities paid and everything. But our scores, our dropout rate, was among the highest in the state. Until Dr. Little came in. Our high school was overcrowded. Students running out the seams. Quarter of a building tall around it. And Dr. Little was able to pass a bond election. A $6 million or $7 million bond election. He failed the first time and he kept it and got it a second time. He started a new high school. And he was very blunt. He told us one day, if you don't do it, DEA is going to make you do it. And he moved on to Kilgore. But he was here 3 years, and he changed the district around completely. He had new ideas. And he was very blunt. And he ran the district, not the board. But my second term, after the second year, it was a lot easier because we were able to get things done with Dr. Little. And he began to hire more Hispanics. Later, Paul Curtis, the finance officer, who'd been there a year and a half, took over. And he hired about six Hispanic administrators. First time in the history of Uvalde, we had a Hispanic band director, Hispanic baseball coach, an assistant superintendent that was Hispanic, principals that were Hispanic, Nacho Mata, Mr. Lozano from Crystal City, Manuel Lozano, came on board. Olivia Talavera, Mary Helen Gonzalez became the bilingual director. And that was just a carryover of what Dr. Little had gotten. And Paul Curtis worked with us very well on that. The high school was completed. Now we're working on getting more Hispanic teachers in the high school. That's been a problem area for the Uvalde School District.
Still,
yes.
Why don't they just hire them?
Well, they have the site-based management program where the teachers have to be involved. And I know my daughter-in-law, certified mathematics teacher, just accepted a job at the junior high because high school would not move fast enough in the contract. But they stall you. They stall you until a week or two before school, and you have to take other employment because you have no assurance that you will be hired. They always wait for the coach's wife to get hired. If a coach comes in, his wife is a math teacher or math minor, they'll try to accommodate her.
So the school board can change that.
Yes, but we haven't been able to have a great influence in the school board. We have three Hispanics right now in the school board, and there's four Anglo.
So the Hispanics only win the zone seats. The at-large still goes to the Anglo.
Right, but see, there's one Hispanic candidate that had won the E-zone, which was at the time 80% is Anglo. Ismael Sosa. They've run good candidates, good Anglo candidates against him, and he would beat them. 2-1.
How does that happen?
Nobody knows. And Ismael is very outspoken. On the school board, he would lower the boom on whatever issue was. And if something unfair, he was never lost for words. I recall when the transportation director retired, they were trying to get his son to be the transportation director, who'd worked there a year or so, a young man of 24, 25 years of age. The next in line was Roland Ortiz, who worked there about 10 years. And there was some talk among the board members to give it to the son. Mendoza let him know right away. He said, we're going to promote from within, and he's next in line, he's going to go. And it happened. A lot of progress has been made. I mean, as you reminisce about the whole thing, you know, we've made a lot of progress here in Uvalde, whether you disagree with me or not, but I can see it. The older you get, the better perspective you have of the whole thing. We have now in Uvalde a Hispanic chief of police. My brother-in-law was the first Hispanic chief of police in Uvalde, and Briscoe appointed him to a higher position with a board of partner bureaus, and he went on.
How did the police intimidate the Mexicanos? You mentioned Ranger Alley before. How about the local sheriff and the local police? How did they intimidate the Mexicanos?
Well, the sheriff had a deputy, a chief deputy, about 6'6", 250-pounder, named Morris Barrow.
What was his name?
Morris Barrow. And he was very hard on Hispanics. And he was charged with brutality a number of times, and you could do anything. And one day, we protested, and city manager wouldn't hear us. And there was an incident involving a guy that was beaten up by Morris Barrow. And they charged him with assaulting a police officer, found him guilty in court, district court. Got 5 years probation, $2,000 fine, you know, whatever. And the guy was beaten. I mean, he was slammed against the floor with his head and everything. All the policemen intervened. Of course, they testified in the, and Morris was the chief of police then. And after I became director of the Community Council of Southwest Texas, the CAP agency, I got to be real good friends with the city manager. The assistant city manager was our board chairman, Alvin Smith. And one day the city manager called me in. He says, you know, you guys have been protesting for a long time against this guy. And Morris had gone off the force because of illness. And he was out of the force for about 2 years, 3 years. And he had just been rehired against the Hispanics' protests. And we were all upset over it. And that morning, Jack Campbell called me to his office. He says, you know, Jack was the city manager. I found something out this morning that I didn't know. You know, we hired Morris Barrow yesterday. Well, I just fired him. That took me by surprise. Man, the guy was almost crying. He says, you know, the case involving the Hispanic that got beaten up in jail in the police department. He said, well, that actually happened. And I began to ask him, well, how'd you know? He said, I had one police officer that came in today from the Houston area. And he heard the news that Morris had been hired. He got here this morning at 7 o'clock. He called me, I want to see you. And he says, Jack, you hired this officer. I want you to know that I've perjured myself in district court. If we hadn't been there, that man would have died. Morris would have killed him. He went wild. Now, 6'6" guy, 240-pounder, 250-pounder. Said it took 4 hours to restrain him, to pull him off. The man wound up in the hospital. And I lied. And I'm going right now to the DA. And I'm going to confess. And of course, they fired him.
What were these people's names? Who was the victim?
Sam Aguilar.
From here?
From here. A plumber. All he went was to inquire about his son who had been detained. And one word led to another, and the officer jumped him.
And this policeman from Houston?
He had worked here, resigned here, and went to Houston.
What's his name?
Gary Ross. He worked for an oil company over there. He was not a policeman anymore.
So the city manager believed Ross?
Yes, sir. If you don't fire him, I'll go to the DA right now. In fact, I'll go to Judge Ross Doty. And of course, that cost. And it further proved our point That afternoon, the officer, who had just been fired, went into the city manager's office and very quietly asked the city manager, "May I talk to you?" The city manager opened the door for him and come on in, turned his back to him, lead him into his office, and the ex-police officer struck him in the back of the head.
Morris.
Knocked him out in City Hall. Jumped on top of him and banged his head against the floor. Sent him to the hospital. The city attorney, who's about 6 foot six, jumped in and before the police came and arrested him, or didn't even arrest him. Sent him to the hospital and everything was hush hush. A lot of things like that had happened. That's one of the reasons that I've been involved, because people had suffered. It was a high price to pay. Sam miraculously escaped serious injury. He had a brain concussion. But after being beaten, he was convicted of assaulting a police officer when it was the other way around. Gary Ross says, "God damn it, even all he did was just grab his head and try to save his life." And Sam weighs about 140 pounds, 150. You imagine a 240, 250 pound jumping on you. And that's one of the reasons that I've stayed involved. And because things have to change. And they have been changing. We have a fine police department right now.
How did the city manager fare?
He went to the hospital, had a brain concussion, and was out of work for about a week.
They didn't charge the police officer with it?
They didn't charge him. He admitted himself to the hospital and had had a case of temporary insanity, whatever you call it.
And he's still around here? He's still a resident?
No, he left. He left. But you know, he changed. Following that time, he had a serious heart attack. He's disabled. But he's a fine fellow now. You see him and you can't believe it's the same guy. I've drank coffee with him. And he admits it. He says, "I'm older now. Man, I hope to God, God forgive me for what I did." He is not the same man he was 20 years ago. That's what I'm trying to point out. His attitude towards Hispanics has changed. Be it because we are in the majority now, be it because he had a religious transformation or whatever, or because of his illness. His sons, the two sons, are excellent young men. They're not, they were not like his father at all.
You said that the city manager called you to tell you the story. Did the city manager also change afterwards?
Well, the city manager, when I became a committee action director, the reason I got elected was he campaigned for me. If you recall, and it was in 1975 that I had applied for committee council, and I went to his office and I talked to him. He said, "You know, you're the right man for that job." He called Judge Tommy Sargent in Brackenfield and recommended me. And he called the county judge in Lakey, called Jake Wallace, and he said, "This is the man we need. He can keep it alive and he can make it grow." And the reason Alvin Smith voted for me was because Jack Apple and the mayor then, Howard Lankford, ordered him to vote for me. Because Alvin Smith was no fan of mine. And you know, incidentally, you knew Alvin Smith. Man, the last 2 years on earth, he was different. He fought for the poor people. You know, he may be hard for you to believe, but I can't believe it because I lived with him. He went to the hospital board, medical staff, and argued for the poor people, for the county clinic. And he told the doctors bluntly, "You don't know what's out there. You need to go out there." And he was campaigning for more funding, and he even came to work for us at the community council, part-time after he retired. He was our biggest advocate the last 2 or 3 years of his life. People need help, he can say. And you know, sometimes we're too blind to see certain things. And his racism that had been displayed earlier was not there anymore. So I want to say that I can see progress. But there's still racism. It's not as obvious, it's more subtle. But people do change.
Okay, can we talk about the second term in the school board? You got a second bite at it.
Okay, I lost a write-in election to Albert Mireles. And then the following year I came back and ran against Rogelio Perez. And that was a dogfight. After the dust settled for the West Zone district, I beat him by 20 votes, 920 to 900.
Explain how that happens. Were the Anglos recruiting Mexican-American candidates, or how did this happen?
Prior to that, the Anglos would recruit a banker and anoint him.
Rudy Flores?
Alfonso Canales.
Okay.
They would recruit someone else from the college, someone else from a business, and they would vote for him to keep a Hispanic in there because to keep HEW or the Justice Department out of the backs. Or off their background. And so what they would do that, they always had a token there. Well, when the single member districts were created, the two districts were created, they had no control over the red zone because we could elect our own. Well, when I ran unopposed. Then Rogelio ran against Alfonso Canales, and we all got together because Rogelio had been involved in the movimiento with the walkout and all that. And so he got elected. And so later on, we had our differences in the school board. And he backed Albert Mireles in the write-in. And they beat me. And I feel real bad because I had not worked hard enough. The following year, I came back and I filed against Rogelio for another West Zone seat. And I beat him by 20 votes. That election was contested. And the judge ordered another election. It didn't take place until maybe 2.5 years later, after all the appeals and court cases were settled. And he beat me by 2 votes. And we became political rivals.
Were you allowed to serve during that time or not?
Yes, I was serving. I had taken the oath. And after the special election, the judge did not allow him to serve because he was not a resident of the valley. He had moved to Austin. And so what they did, the board appointed Frankie Hidalgo to the board. He later became the president. But I was all the time involved with my business. My rent houses, I've accumulated about 37 rental units to be able to be self-employed, not be at the whim of the college, the school district, or the bank, or anywhere else. And so if I see a house that's for sale and it's a good deal, I'll buy it. And I'll get in there, work myself, paint it, fix it up, and rent it. Anyway, I was employed by Southwest Texas Junior College during a time when business was very slow as an adult basic education teacher. And college was a little hesitant to hire me at the time. But Mr. Rudy Flores put in a good word for me. He was the secretary of the board at the time and recommended me, and I'm very thankful for that. And I was able to get the job. I needed it. And so that helped subsidize my income. And I kept growing with the program. When the late Jose Calderon passed away, Jose Calderon was a co-op director out of the junior college in all 9 counties. By that time, my son had been elected to the Board of Trustees.
This is Ronnie.
Ronnie Garza.
What's his business?
He right now he's a school teacher.
Okay.
But he's involved with real estate, Century 21. And Ronnie's a young man, I was 26 at the time when he ran. And he's the first, he and Rudy Espinosa of Crystal City are the first persons ever elected outright to the Board of Trustees of the Junior College. Not only the first Hispanics elected outright, but the first persons elected, period. In the past, the Junior College would sort of, a board would sort of perpetuate itself. If an incumbent was tired of being there, he would resign. There was 2 or 3 years left in his term. They would appoint someone of their liking, and then he would run as an incumbent. Well, we organized a massive election. We formed a coalition with Rudy Espinosa at Zavala County. And here's what we did, basically. Rudy, you help us in Zavala, we'll help you here.
These are at-large elections, right?
at large.
That district has been sued, but that suit was lost.
We lost that suit. It's still under appeal.
It's still under appeal.
Under appeal, Supreme Court.
Of the United States?
Yes. Anyway,
did the Fifth Circuit affirm the local ruling or?
Affirmed. See, the ruling was that we were 52% of the population. 52% were Hispanic. We were the majority, we could change it if we wanted to. And Judge Emilio Garza, I hate to say it, he's another John Wood. He's a Republican. And that's what we figured we were going to lose. I was talking to George Corbell before the court case. He said, well, it's going to be hard. Judge Prado will not hear it. And I asked, what's the difference? They're both Republicans, yes, but Prado graduated from Edgewood High School. Prado used to be a Democrat. Now this guy, Judge Garza graduated from Holy Cross High School. He's always been a Republican. So he's got a different way of thinking. And sure enough, we lost that case. We had a good case, but we lost it. Anyway, after that case was lost, I testified against the college while being an employee of the college. I really put my neck on the line. My whole career was there. And the college did not retaliate, and I'm grateful for that. They respected me. And so the following year, my son files for the Junior College Board of Trustees and wins that election. And he and Rudy Spinoza won by at least 250 votes. And everybody said it was a fluke, you know, you were lucky you won it. Well, I didn't believe so. People were more aware of what was going on at the college. The fact that we only had a Hispanic for 20 years there on the Board of Trustees. So 2 years later, Bobby Lopez and Tommy Flores run for the Board of Trustees. And they lose by about 400 votes. This year, Bobby Lopez filed against Whitaker. And Rodolfo Flores was running on the post. And Bobby defeats Whitaker, who's been there 22 years. So now Hispanics have majority.
That's only four.
Four out of seven.
Oh, I thought there were nine. There's seven seats?
Seven seats.
But Mr. Flores, isn't he an employee of Briscoe? Doc Briscoe? Has been historically, no?
He used to be, but he's a private attorney now. And he's the president of the board. And Ronnie is the secretary of the board. And now Hispanics form a majority of the council seats.
It's still at large.
Still at large.
So technically the other seats are available coming up.
Two more coming up. In 2 years, Rudy Spinoza and Ronnie Garza are up for election. And I know they're coming after us. But we're going to work together. See, but won the election for Ronnie and Rudy was Laval County. We were losing by about 1,000 votes until the Crystal City Independent School District came in. And we picked up about 1,400 votes there, and that carried us over. Now this year, Bobby Lopez was losing, and when Laval County came in, he went over the hill. He won. The only thing we wanted to do here in Uvalde County was not to lose so big. Because they beat you by 1,500 votes, it's almost impossible for Uvalde County to help you.
Real County is still in the district, no? It's Real, Uvalde, and Zavala that makes up the district.
Right. So, it's been a hard struggle throughout the years to be able to be here to get to this point. In February, I filed for mayor of Uvalde. And two other Hispanics filed against Granville. Raul Flores, formerly from Crystal City, and Rick Perez, a member of a large family here in Uvalde, filed. Lecho Quiroga filed, but he was in a post. He's been there 25 years. He's the dean of all the councilmen. And so I ran against a very prominent person, Bert McNally. His father at one time was the president of the First State Bank. And we worked our campaign door to door. We concentrated on the absentee in person. And that's where they were the strongest. And we concentrated on absentee by mail. That's where we're the strongest. And Election Day, we beat him by about 250 votes, just on Election Day. And the absentee, we beat him by another 200 votes. I pulled, I believe, 800 some to 500 something. We won by 60% of the vote. It shocked everybody. Even shocked me. I thought maybe 100 votes, less than 100. But once the preliminary results came in, and the West, in the East zone, where they're the strongest, he beat me by 55% of the vote. And in the West zone, I beat him by about 85% of the vote. So I knew I had won, because we knew, we were projecting that we would have won the absentee pick.
Was there any problems for Raul Flores being from Crystal City, an outsider? This is unusual.
Well, there was, Raul's been here 10 years. He's involved with the community council. And we have embraced him. Because a lot of the persons involved with the Movimiento can relate to Crystal City. And so Raul has never been a stranger here in Uvalde.
How about, there was a lot of Anglo families who claimed to have moved to Uvalde so they could put their kids in here when they left Crystal City. Was it true, or if it's true, did they also leave by now? Or?
No, I don't think so. There was a different type of election. There was some skepticism during the election and then after the election. But I believe that at this point in time, they have accepted the fact that five Hispanics will be the city council and one Anglo. But we have all lived here. I've lived here 42 years almost. Ricky was born and raised here. His father's a contractor who's been here all his life. And we've always had dealings with the banks. And one of the reasons that I ran, and I guess I'm speaking for the others, is that for the last 10 or 12 years, the West Side has been neglected. Services are ignored or not done. And people wanted new blood in there. They wanted some fairness. And like I said, we've come a long way. We have a Hispanic city manager, a Hispanic chief of police, and the majority of employees in City Hall are Hispanics. But Anglos control the City Hall. 3-2. And of course the mayor is 4-2. A lot of things don't get done because the emphasis is on the East Side. And so people on the West Side, the Hispanic people in general, want some changes.
Now, the city council, is that at large, or by places, or districts, and the mayor runs at large?
Well, the mayor runs at large, and it's places, imaginary places. They used to be at large, and 2 years ago, there was a question, because Raul lost by very few votes.
Flores?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the other candidate won the election without a majority, without a 50%, 50.1%. So the court case, so the charter was amended and voted upon to change it, to go to places, which we felt at this time was to our advantage. And the election was changed from a Tuesday, from the first Tuesday in November to the first Saturday in May. So the Saturday is to our advantage because our people don't work on Saturday. And they're there and we're able to get to their home. This is a factor that was involved in our election, a larger turnout. And it helped us. If it had been on a Tuesday, we probably would have maybe lost it or maybe not win it so comfortably.
What has been the role of the newspaper? And have there been any kind of newspapers here?
Yeah, we have had El Uvalde Times. Olga Rodriguez had it for a while. And it was never really accepted. But she had it for about a year, 2 years, and then it went under.
That was a Chicano paper?
Yes. And then La Politiquera made an initial effort here with Alfredo Santos. And it just didn't quite hit, but it's a good paper. And the Iglada Leader News is very Anglo, and very little for Hispanics. And it was owned by Mrs. Hornby. Sold it to Craig Arnett, and Craig has done a wonderful job with it. But very few Hispanic items appear in the newspaper. And we don't foresee any possibility of in the future. Unless the paper changes philosophy. They don't report too much controversy, they just try to keep it down to a minimum. And but that's the role of the newspaper.
Is the state representative district now include still Zavala and Valle and Medina and Frio and Real, or what are the district of state representative?
Well, Medina, Uvalde, Zavala, Dimit, Frio, and Guardaway. We elected a first Hispanic state representative, Pedro Nieto, as a Democrat. So he changed parties in the middle of his term, went to Republican, and that cost him the election. Tracy King, whom Nieto had beaten earlier, beat him this time around by about 400 votes. Pedro put up a big fight. But now Pedro is the first Republican elected to a countywide office. He's a new county attorney. And he's elected as a Republican. Unopposed.
No Democrat ran?
Democrat.
There's not enough lawyers in the county.
Well, it doesn't pay that much either. Because it sort of ties you up with handling civil cases only. You can't very well represent criminal cases because you're the county attorney, you're the prosecutor. So, Lydia Steele, I believe her maiden name is Flores, is a district clerk. She's been there for 2 terms, been reelected easily. That's one thing that hurt us in the federal court case against the junior college. Ismael Sosa was elected from the E-Zone, 2-1. In Lakey, Manuel Rubio was elected county clerk, unopposed. Very few Hispanics over there. Then Lita Steele gets elected district clerk. Maggie Del Toro gets elected county clerk. And the E-Zone precinct vote for him by a large majority. So you can't pinpoint. It was harder for George Corbett to pinpoint discrimination or.
Who is the Anglo power structure here now?
Well, Mr. Briscoe, I would say.
Still. And who are his cronies, or how does he have his network? Is it employees? Is it
I don't know, but he has a lot to say so. Pete Knowles is another gentleman that gets very much involved.
It's the dairy farmer, no? Or,
no, Pete Knowles is the former owner of Gensco.
Oil.
Then became president and chairman of the board of directors of Gensco, a subsidiary of Shamrock Corporation.
Oh.
That big pipe company. And at one time, it was 300 employees. And Shamrock sold it to someone else, and they relocated away from the U.S.
And in the Mexicano community, who are the power brokers?
Well, I would say Jesse Moreno.
Who is he?
He is a county commissioner, Gilbert Torres. People that relate to the people. You have Rolf Flores, the attorney.
Ah, what was that break between him and Briscoe? What happened?
I really don't know, but he did resign from the bank and reopened his law practice. He was had a law practice before he went to work for Briscoe. And he worked for Briscoe for 20 years. And he has a very prosperous law practice rather. But I don't know exactly what transpired, but you know, he retired from the bank.
Who's the president of the community college now, and what changes have been there? There used to be a Matthews.
Wade Matthews retired many years ago. Then Dr. Goodson, Jimmy Goodson, took over. He resigned, went to Victoria College. And Billy Word was elected president about 4 or 5 years ago. And he is the president right now.
Is he under a contract, or is he just a...
I believe he has a contract. It's like a school superintendent. Every year they add a year to it. But he has worked it pretty well. Have employed Hispanic teachers in teaching positions. And the board as a whole have made an effort to be more open than when Wayne Matthews was there. When Wayne Matthews had to be a PhD, and then he still wouldn't hire
him. If he were Mexican.
Yes.
Is he still live around here, and is he actively involved in politics?
Well, he's still around. He's very feeble now. But he did get involved in this last election. He was campaign manager for Williger. And he was visibly disappointed when Williger didn't get reelected.
Did he go out and campaign against Ronnie?
Oh, yeah. They made the rounds. Campaigned against Robert Lopez. Yeah, he wants to live to see the day that his parents were proposed in college.
Did he actually campaign like that to keep the Mexicans out?
Well, yes. Not only him, there were others involved. There's a lot of money involved in community college. And there are many estates that have been deeded to the junior college. Garner gave the junior college $6 million.
But they've sold all those stocks to themselves, no? I remember I tried to get them investigated about them and did not succeed.
I don't really know that much about it, but the Witt family wheeled the junior college about a 3,000 acre ranch, mineral rights and everything. It's a lot of money there. And it's another family that deeded a lot of land to the college. The lady LaFarre gave the college 300 lots. They yourself keep the money. So, the college has a lot of money in the bank.
Briscoe's Bank.
City Hall has a lot of money. Gets me back often.
Well,
but, you know, with all due respect and in all honesty, I believe that's the most favorable bank for Hispanics here in the valley at this time. And I had some financial reverses about 6 or 7 years ago, and I was dealing with Blue Bonnet Savings and Loan, NBC Bank, Uvalde Savings and Loan. Then Commodore Savings and Loan took over Blue Bonnet. Man, they were trying to foreclose on me like this. I missed the payment, they wanted to take over my house, take over my office, put liens on my property. And the First State Bank was a little hard too. But I went to Mr. Crisco and sat in his office for about an hour waiting for him. And I told my predicament. What do you want me to do? I said, give me more time. I'm down, but I'm not out. I just need some time. I was 6 payments behind them. You talk about $3,000 a month. I own a little ranch. I was paying $1,000 a month on it. I think about $700 a month a year, $700 in my house. He called the president of the bank, says, work with Mr. Garza, he's been here a long time, work something out for him. And in 6 months, I narrowed the gap to two payments. Whereas the other institution was trying to take my house away from me, or my buildings, my apartments. I know one of them, Blue Bonnet, how they handle payments, and I want to make the payments. Oh, we need three. Now you're talking about $1,500 a month. I said, well, I don't owe you three. Well, but you will in 10 days, so we need all three of them. Or we'll call you no then. I both make three payments, they want four. Making it so hard for me to pay. Why? Because I had a lot of equity. You know, from $75,000 to $80,000 to $25,000, you know. On the note, they could take it over, sell it, make a lot of money. And they were ugly about it. I know the branch manager here told me so many words, we'll never come back unless they have four payments. I knew if I had taken four payments, he wanted five. Because he was calling the shots. I go to Leland Kirby, a local attorney, ask for advice. He said, go ahead and take the three payments. But take a witness with you. Coming out of his office in the courthouse yard, I met Commissioner Torres. And I asked him, go with me. But don't speak, just hear. Because Commissioner Torres can get very atomic, you know. You sit there and you hear everything that takes place. I may need you as a witness. Because they're not going to take my apartment away from me. They're not going to take my house away from me. So I went back an hour or 2 hours later and I said, I want to give you three payments on the note. Man, the bank manager rushes up there and points a finger at me. I already told you, Mr. Garza, that you have four payments, don't even come in here. I said, well, but if I bring you four, you're going to want five. You've been increasing it every time I come. I don't owe you four. I only owe you three, and I've got three payments right here, $1,500 each. And he told me so many words. Where to go? He said, do I understand you to say that you are not accepting my money? You refuse to accept my three payments? That is exactly what I'm telling you. Okay, sir. There's a witness right here. He turns around and sees Gilbert. Of course, he knew Gilbert. He said, wait a minute. He literally ran upstairs. And about a minute later, he calls, go ahead and take the three payments. He wanted my businesses because I had a lot of collateral in it. Imagine they would sell it for double the price and only owed them $25,000 or $30,000. Now, the First State Bank was very cordial, very sensitive, and very approachable. Evaldi Savings Alone was trying to foreclose on a commercial property I have here next door on two payments. And I made an arrangement with them. I said, look, I'm going to give you three payments. And they went ahead and posted it on the bulletin board of the courthouse. And if Commissioner Torres hadn't seen it, they probably would have sold it at auction. And the guy had promised to wait. I go back and meet him and call it to his attention. He said, I didn't tell you anything. You don't have it in writing. I said, but you told me. But they wanted my properties. But if all those banks or a lending institution, the First State Bank has been the most approachable. For me, anyway.
I understand that Briscoe has also supported Morales this time around. You all have been active in the Democratic Party now?
Yes, we've been active in the Democratic Party. And we had a luncheon for Victor Morales, and Mr. Briscoe and his wife were there, and he pledged his support. He said, I'll support the Democratic Party. I'm a Democrat, I've always been a Democrat. I don't intend to switch. He was host, he and Mr. Briscoe, to Hillary Clinton in March when she was here. And he endorsed President Clinton. He's a Democrat and wants to endorse him. And they were reminiscing about the time Harry Truman came to visit John Garner and received John Garner's endorsement. Supposedly that helped him carry Texas and win the election. So Clinton is hoping that. See, we've done something here in Uvalde also that we don't advertise. We have a very strong citizenship program. Just alone here in Uvalde, in the last 5 years, I venture to say 500 people have become citizens.
Who's we?
Southwest Texas Junior College has an adult basic education program. And one of the requirements is that we offer citizenship classes. The rules have been relaxed, I believe, in San Antonio anyway. I don't know about the rest of the country. But if a person is 50 years of age and they live here legally 20 years, they can take a test in Spanish. That's an advantage. If they're 55 years of age and have lived here legally 15 years, they can take it in Spanish. Now, if they're 65 years of age and have been here more than 20 years, even if they don't pass a test, they pass. As long as they make an effort to study with us. Every application we make, we stamp our name on it. And we take them, we take 35, we just had about 40 that were sworn in Del Rio Friday. And of course they're registered to vote. We register them to vote when they pass the exam in San Antonio. And we hold a registration card until they're sworn in. Monday morning I will file them with the tax assessor and collector.
Is this district-wide or just here in Uvalde?
Just here in Uvalde. Now in Eagle Pass, about 1,000. In Eagle Pass, it's the result of the amnesty program. In Crystal City, we have a citizenship center also. And that's not as many, but we take 40 or 50 every year. Brackettville, we've had for the last 2 years 35 people that become citizens every year. They go to our center. And one of the things that we do, we take them over there in the college van. Because people have a problem getting to San Antonio, even finding the office. It's way out there in the northeast side. On the 35, going to Austin, in Selma, right by Selma. So, you know, we take them over there, and they're holding their hand when they take a test, and we teach them the key questions they're going to ask them in Spanish or in English. But now there's a need because of Proposition 187 in California, and people wanting to vote in November because they're afraid if Dole gets elected and the Republicans maintain control of the Senate and the House, we're doomed. And they know it. So there's a new interest in wanting to vote.
How did the movement of the Chicanos in the late 60s, 70s help bring all this about?
Well, a lot of credit goes to La Raza Unida political party. It created an awareness, for one, of what you can do. It got people involved. And it created a pride in a person that, you know, we can do it. Another thing is, another factor, it forced the Democratic Party to open doors for Hispanics. And I have always said, and I'll continue to say it, that Dan Morales got elected because the party had to open doors. And La Raza Unida not ever existed, I doubt if Dan Morales could have been elected statewide. The party got behind him. Henry Cisneros came about because of La Raza Unida political party. There was an awareness created in San Antonio and South Texas about Hispanics being elected. And I've always said, and I'll just continue to say it here in Uvalde, it opened doors for us. It forced us to unite. And because the party, the Democratic Party, was very insensitive and very indifferent to Hispanics. They wanted our vote, but no commitment. They want to come right before election day and buy beer for all the Hispanic people here, tamales. And so Joe Diegas and Tafoya can say, hey, we don't want your tamales, we don't want your beer. What are you going to do for us? And of course, our conservative Democrats, who actually were Republicans, well, we can't, no, you do something for us, or we're not going to help you. And we start doing that. I supported a Republican for a state representative. And we interviewed the Republican and the Democrat from Palo Pinto, close to San Angelo, told us, I'm not going to do anything for Hispanics. And Harvey Hildebrand met with us and said, whatever you need, let me know and I'll work with you. And he has.
I thought your state representative was Tracy King.
Well, that's before Tracy King.
I see.
There was a redistricting in during the 1990 census.
So how does Uvalde Mexican Americans vote for a Bonilla congressman?
Well, they didn't really vote for him. The Anglo voted for him. Hispanics went with Albert Bustamante. But Albert lost touch with the people. When Albert was campaigning against Chick Kazin, he would come to my office.
He would go across the street to Rogelio Perez's office. He would go to Gilbert Torres' house, to Mario Cardona's house. He would visit with Henry Vasquez. But after he got elected, he would go to the country club, to the junior college, to the bank. And so Gilbert Torres, bless his heart, he's the only one that can do this. One day, call it to his attention. What's wrong with you? Now you don't need us anymore. You already won the election. Now you're favoring the people that actually opposed you. But here in Evalde, Albert Bustamante won big time with the Crisco endorsed him. But then Bustamante came in and defeated him. Big time.
I run out of questions. You have things you want to say that we have not covered. I know that you were a real good friend with Hick Tafoya and he passed away. I know that you've been struggling and running forever, never letting the issues die. You conciliated all the factions and that's how you won. You got plans for the future. You're on the verge of a lot of influence at the community college. There's a lot of things that are out there. But, I don't know what to ask you anymore.
On Gabriel Tafoya, he was a pioneer in the Chicano movement with Mayo. And he just burned himself out. His passing away was a great loss because we took it personally. I had the honor of delivering the eulogy at his funeral. And Gabe had a way with people. And at that eulogy, I said, if somebody can be called el amigo del pueblo, it has to be Gabe. Because even when we were down, according to Gabe, we were not down. His favorite expression, dale gas. Dale gas, no te rajes. And his health began to slow him down, and I would say that would be the main reason he phased himself out of politics. He got sick in 1974, after I believe a trip to Mexico, and he never fully recuperated until he finally caused his untimely death in April, I believe, at the age of 52. But he was another Willy Velasquez, a fireball until his health began to fail him.
April of 96.
Yes. And he just kind of faded away, and I know it was his health. He didn't have the stamina, he didn't have the fire that wasn't there anymore. So, but we dedicated this victory to Gabriel, because he deserved it. Everything he sowed, we were reaping. I mean, he sacrificed. Not only for us, but for other people. Same thing with the Raza Unida Party. Some of the founders had to sacrifice careers, finances, so others could benefit from it. I know here in Uvalde, for the longest time, I couldn't get a job because of the walkout, because of supporting Grand Humanese, and because of being controversial. And not only the participants like myself, but my wife. And they went out to the family. My son couldn't get a job for a long time because he was my son. He applied for a job at Nations Bank, and with a college degree, they weren't going to give it to him until I called the president and put in a good word for him. And the president had served on the school board with me and asked him for another interview and hired him. But Mr. Gasson's son, be careful. See, many times, you have to speak out. You have to make a stand on an issue. I'll never forget Dr. Dwayne Campbell at California State University. He would say, many times you have to go back one or two steps, later go forward 3 or 4. And I've always considered myself a change agent. And by no means do I want to be a suicide agent. But I figured that if I was self-employed, had my own business, and didn't depend on the establishment for employment, I would be in a better position to register people to vote, to be active in the community. And I'm not the vocal type, the confrontational type that will confront an issue, and I like to be more like a bridge builder. I will talk to people and try to get people to understand and compromise and work things out, because when you don't have the resources to win, you have to compromise. I'll never forget Pat Maloney one day when I asked him, how do you win your cases? And he said, George, you pound on the facts. Pound on the facts. I said, but what if you don't have any facts? You pound on the table. And that's what many times we were doing, pounding on the table, because we wanted to keep people interested. And I plan to continue until the day I die. I'm involved in church work. That's the center of our lives, my family. I'm a deacon in our church, Temple Cristiano Assembly of God, and I plan to continue. And one of the things that I believe in very strongly is in a peaceful demonstration. I believe that if we let hate govern our lives, eventually that hate is going to conquer us like a cancer. And then we will be able to function because of the hate. The last few years that Mr. Byron, the superintendent, Superintendent Byron that fired me, the last 10 years of his life, 15 years of his life, I sat and drank coffee with him. The last 2 years of his life, he was feeble, sick old man of 85 years of age. And every time I would sit with him, he would apologize for firing me. I said, Garza, I did you wrong. You didn't deserve to get fired. And earlier, a principal, a high school principal, tried to pull the same stunt, terminating a baseball coach. And went to the superintendent, said, either the coach goes or I go, but you select. And a real dear friend of mine was there at that meeting. Byron blew up. He lost his school. He said, I had a principal 7 years ago that put me in the same predicament you put me in right now. And never again would anybody put me in that predicament. He said, Mr. Garza did not deserve to get fired. I terminated him because I had to support my principal. And I did him a great injustice. He said, Mr. Garza did not deserve to get fired. Yeah, he had addressed the principal, he said, there's the door, you want to be present. I'm going to make my own decision, and don't try to put me in a compromising position. I said, drink coffee with him. I loved it. I liked him. Because when you hold grudges, especially political grudges, they eat you up. And sometimes love permeates society. When you lack compassion, then you're in trouble. It's so good to be on top. But then when the guy's down, it's hard to kick him, for me. I don't believe in retaliating. I believe in giving people a second and third chance. And community council director, you know, I kind of have to fire people because they broke the rules. And two things happen when you rehire them. They're either going to violate the rules again, or they're going to be your best employees. And 90% of the time, they're your best employees. They can even become your best friends because you had a heart and you gave them a second chance. And that's one thing that I don't have any animosity towards anybody, even Mr. Barham, who already passed away, Mr. Shannon, the guy that was instrumental in getting me fired. Before we left Uvalde, we had a cup of coffee. We shook hands. And he apologized to me. He said you didn't deserve to get fired. But see, it was fear in their hearts and their minds that caused them to do that. Because we're the majority. It was fear. Fear of what? Of the unknown. When they can control your mind, they're afraid of you. But if they can break your spirit, they can control you.
Is the younger generation of Anglos fearful, or are they accustomed to the change, or they're not even around anymore? Are they leaving?
Well, a lot of them are here, but they're more accustomed to the fact that Hispanics are here. Because a student council president is a Hispanic. When I was in high school, we couldn't get anybody elected. And so when we went to junior college and had a chance of getting elected, they were afraid of us. Because that's too many of us. But there's still racism. And it's among a lot of church-going people. I know the school board that fired me, those, you know, you call quote-unquote Christian men, God-fearing men. And in their heart, they thought they were doing the right thing. One of them went to federal court to testify against us with a Bible in his hand. And the guy, by all accounts, a fine Christian gentleman. But he believed that Hispanics should be segregated. A lot of changes have taken place. They may not be so favorable to us taking over, but they're more tolerant of it. They're accepting it a lot better than the parents were. But some of the old timers that had perpetuated segregation, discrimination, are gone. And their kids are not as bad as their parents were.
Are you involved with any national civil rights groups or local civic groups or anything as a member?
I'm a member of LULAC.
LULAC, there's a LULAC chapter here?
Yes. And I'm a member of the American Legion. Been a card carrying member for over 25 years. That's about the extent of my involvement with civic. I'm always too busy.